programming support is brought to you by Orbit DVD, located at 781 Haywood Road in West Asheville. Since 2003, Orbit has sold classic, foreign, and cult DVDs, video games, comics, rare and unusual books, and used electronics. For more information, visit orbitdvd.com or call 828-251-1337.
You're listening to Asheville FM at WSFM LP 103.3 Asheville, and this is the AFM NewsHour. I'm News Team Correspondent KP Whaley. The AFM NewsHour theme music is composed by local artist Alusha Tistas. Views and opinions expressed on the AFM NewsHour do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, its board of directors, or program sponsors. For questions, feedback, story suggestions, and more, please email us at news@ashevillefm.org, and you can also find our stories on Facebook at Asheville FM. On today's edition of the AFM NewsHour, Asheville City Council considers a business improvement district again, and Asheville Blade editor says it's still a bad idea. Operation Gateway seeks to improve the lives of formerly incarcerated citizens. The newly formed Justice for All NC party tries to get Cornell West on the ballot. Dr. Dick Needleman brings us our daily dose of healthy Asheville and the Tailgate Market Report. But first, let's take a look at this week's headlines. News Team correspondent Cannon Wiest is out this week. In local news, the city of Asheville is reporting that stormwater crews are repairing a stormwater pipe on Rankin Avenue at the intersections of Hiawassee Street today. The section of Rankin Avenue near the intersection will be closed until approximately 5 p.m. while the repair is being made. Please make adjustments to your travel plans. In state news, former Western North Carolina Congressman Madison Cawthorn has struck a Florida Highway Patrol car, injuring a trooper this week. This from a Florida Highway Patrol and a witness who posted the video and still photos on social media. The trooper was brought to a hospital with minor injuries, and the driver, believed to be Cawthorn, was cited with violating Florida's move over law, which requires motorists to slow down and move over a lane when approaching a law enforcement vehicle parked on a highway shoulder. The Twitter poster said the Mercedes that was driven had been, quote, erratically and aggressively driving behind her before she moved out of the left lane to let it pass. Then she later said she saw the wrecked vehicle and Cawthorn in a wheelchair on the side of the road and posted pictures and videos with the person who appears to be Madison Cawthorn. In national news, former President Donald Trump was back in court for a second day in his Manhattan criminal trial, accused of covering up providing hush money to a porn star to help his 2016 presidential campaign. Trump faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to conceal payments to Stormy Daniels, who has said she and Trump had sex in 2006, not long after Melania Trump gave birth to their son, Barron. Trump denies the claim. Prosecutors allege the falsification was done to conceal violating federal campaign finance contribution limits and a plan to violate New York tax and election laws, making the crimes felonies. Trump is claiming that the trial is a Biden-inspired witch hunt and it should end, without providing any evidence that Biden had a role in Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg's decision to bring those charges. And that's about it for this week's headlines. Asheville City Council's considering a BID, or Business Improvement District, and Asheville Blade editor David Forbes joins us to discuss why they think it's still a bad idea. David Forbes, thank you so much for joining us again.
Always a pleasure.
So the Asheville City Council is considering a BID, that's a Business Improvement District. There's been a lot of hype by the Chamber of Commerce, as well as the Downtown the Business Association, Downtown Association. And there was a push of many years ago to get a bid in the city then, and it was fought back by a lot of citizens not happy with the idea. And you say it's still a bad idea.
Yes, it's still a terrible idea. I think it's worth making clear what a bid is, because there's been, frankly, so much, as you say, hype, but not just hype. I'd go farther and say outright deception around this. Mm. A bid is not a handful of business owners or a few like residents taxing themselves, which is a term we've heard. A bid is a tax imposed by the government on everyone in an area, and realistically, renters and commercial tenants, and I am a renter in downtown, obviously, so some perspective on this, would pay through rents getting passed on in almost every case, obviously. You know, that overwhelmingly happens when a property tax goes up, the landlord passes it along to the renters, the tenants, as soon as they can. But unlike, you know, the taxes of local government, which as many problems as local government has structurally and with specific stuff they do, at least there's the idea that everyone gets, you know, a vote come election time to see if they can, you know, supposedly change who's on there. This kind of even ditches that facade of like one person, one vote, no taxation representation. It doesn't even try to do that. Instead, all that money that they collect, it'll be about $1.25 million according to projections, probably a little more considering tax, you know, property values getting reevaluated next year, will go to a private organization whose governing board will be appointed initially in secret by the Chamber, Downtown Association, probably some of their similar business groups. And then that board will choose, as the plan stands now, will choose its own successors. And half the seats on that board are reserved for property owners with assets at least over $1.5 million. So this is, and actually the transparency group, Sunshine Labs, who run the Sunshine Request open record site, put out a statement yesterday saying this is, you know, this is clearly another unelected board like the TDA that is just governed for the interest of few. And, you know, that's a pretty well respected, you know, transparency group. And pointing out that, you know, the board will be heavily undemocratic. You know, this is directly the wealthy having the only real say over public tax dollars. They have seats on this board for like a renter, but like, again, it's a renter chosen by wealthy business owners. Right. So a lot of us in downtown, everyone pretty much would pay this tax in some form and, you know, would see rents go up, you know, attendantly if they rent, but would have zero say in what was done with it. And what's done with bids tax money tends to be pretty terrible.
Yeah, and you also mentioned, you know, when you have these wealthy people in the position of power that are actually doing the hiring of the private consultants that are going to be, you know, essentially policing the downtown area, for lack of a better word. And so you're going to get what you pay for, right? These people are going to be very interested in their interests, which means, you know, homeless folks out of the way of tourists and worse.
Yes, exactly. And that's the thing. And, you know, the bid has been presented in the flyers that a lot of us in downtown received, the marketing of it, as this kind of uncontroversial best practice. And that's completely untrue. It is an understatement to say that's untrue. Bids have been around since the 70s. So we've got lots of records of how they do and don't act. And their track record's pretty terrible. In addition to the structural problems, talk about taxing everyone and only spending it for kind of the benefit of a few. They have an extensive record of harassing locals, especially homeless people, but also mutual aid workers, protesters, queer and transgender people, BIPOC folks, buskers, you know, the list goes on. Basically, if you don't look like you own five houses, the bid is not being run for you. And, you know, we go into this in our latest article, which is called Stop the Bid, which is a pretty in-depth look at all this. We've got plenty of links to back this up. You see lawsuit after lawsuit, bids, you know, assaulting homeless people directly sometimes, like illegally confiscating their stuff, just, you know, kicking out street vendors and illegally confiscating their stuff, helping the police circumvent, you know, laws preventing them from surveilling peaceful protests. Or having a black organizer who was, you know, of a community group that was opposing the bid arrested for assault, for, you know, supposedly for assault for blowing an air horn at a rally, which is totally legal to do. So, like, you know, this is government by the wealthy for the wealthy, and it's pretty unabashed form. And Asheville doesn't look to be any exception on that. And you've seen recently the chamber and some of the folks with it. Actually, we had the Zach Wallace, the VP of the chamber, public policy VP of the chamber, is kind of heading up this push from their end, say in response to Blade's coverage, well, we're not pushing for private security. and this is disingenuous. This is a word game, and it's false. They claim, you know, we only have these teams of uniformed ambassadors. They make them sound like greeters at a Walmart or something. But if you actually read the bid operational plan, the thing actually spells out what they want to do. They say that they want, and I quote, uniformed patrols, and that these patrols will be on the keep an eye out and surveil, and I quote, anything deemed out of the ordinary, and that they will be particularly concerned with, and I quote again, antisocial behaviors, or behaviors that are unacceptable in public.
Right.
And I don't know about you, but like, as someone in a group whose very existence is considered by plenty of conservative business owners as a trans person to not be acceptable in public, those words are deeply chilling.
Yeah.
And given big track records, they should be even more chilling. So yes, that is a private security force, a uniform patrol that's supposed to, you know, surveil stuff and target stuff and take proactive action with stuff. That is private security in all but, you know, in all but name. They are playing a semantic game because of how disturbing this stuff is.
Yeah.
And you even see this because, like, Kim McQueen, who was a big supporter of the bid in the earlier bid proposal in the 2010s, which I've covered extensively as a reporter for Mountain Express at the time, straight up said, when asked by Mountain Express now, said, hey, look, one of the things we could do was, like, hire private security, more private security if we wanted it. And once a bid is in place, there's very, very, very few constraints on what they do with that money. And I'd encourage people to read our article because bids around the country have a record of not just their ambassadors acting as de facto private security, even to the point of, like, assaulting homeless people, but even hiring armed private security, like plate carriers and handguns and rifles and all that stuff. You know, this institution has a very ugly record.
Yeah. And further in your article and reading it further, you know, you mentioned the fact that if anyone looks out of the ordinary, well, if anyone's going to look out of the ordinary, it's anybody in Asheville, you know,
yeah,
in terms of downtown businesses, you know, we're known for looking weird and just even the employees. And so I worry about, you know, employee harassment. If someone gets out of work late in the evening, if we look different or out of the ordinary. And more importantly,
that's an excellent point. Yeah.
The gentrification point of that in your article was also very chilling for Asheville, known for its local independent businesses. You see in other cities when a bid is introduced, sort of the homogenization of corporate chains.
Exactly. That's also an excellent point. That's the thing. This article is very in depth because there's that many problems with bids. You know, which area do you want to turn to? You know, civil liberties, human rights, and also local businesses get driven out. And you know, the thing is, this is pretty well acknowledged even by fairly centrist urban planners. There's an article in the New Republic by kind of a reporter on urbanism and things like that. The New Republic is not a radical publication.
They're not. Yeah, they're not an anarchist news organization like yours.
Yeah, they're not an anarchist news organization like, you know, some of us, or a leftist news organization like some of us. But, like, their article straight up said business improvement districts ruin neighborhoods, flat out. There was a 2013 study done by Columbia University of bids in New York, which has the most of them of any city in the country. And it outright found that employment and revenue among independent businesses when a business improvement district hits go down. They get driven out of the area. And it makes a lot of sense because the tax, you know, seats are reserved on the bid board literally for the wealthiest property owners. And a lot of business owners, especially a lot of smaller independent ones, aren't property owners either. They're commercial tenants. They rent. So really, you know, if you want homogenization, you know, support a bid because you're going to see more chain stores. This is run by the wealthy for the wealthy. And over time that pushes even the small business is supposed to, you know, be in the interest of get pushed out too. Mm. And a lot of cases they get pushed out pretty quick.
Yeah.
And that's especially true of, you know, because, it dovetails the other stuff, you know, people aren't, you know, if say someone has a bar with a lot of queer clientele, if they're regularly getting harassed by the bid's private security, people aren't going to want to come to that neighborhood anymore.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
The revenue dries up, so the place closes. You know, this is a pretty established pattern. And, you know, the fact among planners that bids are overwhelmingly pretty negative for smaller and independent businesses is not particularly controversial at this point.
So let's talk about like the next steps then, because it seems like this is getting rapidly pushed through. There's been, again, a lot of hype around it. It was discussed at the last city council meeting, and there's plan for it to be on the agenda the next meeting.
Yeah, so there's a public hearing at the next meeting, April 23rd. Unusually, that meeting starts at 4 p.m. in the Civic Center. Also unusually, the bid public hearing, which, you know, it's a big issue, I think they put it front and center, they have put it very last on the agenda. And this is something I think folks should be really aware of. From the evidence, though, we are seeing some stuff shift as you see more public pushback. The mayor especially and some of the more concerned mayor city council really want to push this through as rapidly as possible. For some of the reasons we just mentioned, the more people find out about the business improvement district, the more disturbing it sounds, the more people get mobilized against it. We saw that with the last bid that was proposed in the 2010s, was that as time went on, more people got mobilized against it, and it eventually floundered and got defeated due to that and some other problems. But like, so now they're really trying to just push it through rapid speed this time. As it stands, and this is one of the issues that Sunshine Labs criticized in their open letter yesterday, there is only going to be 1 hour total allowed for public comment on the bid. That will be the only opportunity for public comment. So odds are you will, you know, I'm not telling folks not to show up. By all means, show up, be ready to speak. But City Council, as it stands, is things on a first-come, first-served basis. So a lot of folks, you'll probably have a lot of chamber folks over that showing up at 4 p.m., signing up, and then they'll be first. And if there's only an hour allowed for public comment, that might be the only people who get to speak. So as we encourage in the article, you know, basically anything that slows this down, anything that gets the word out about this, we've even seen since our article has gone out, even like downtown property saying, this is a terrible idea. I don't support this. You know, so you are, you know, outside of the fairly small cliques in pushing this, which are loud and influential, but aren't particularly numerous.
Yeah.
You know, we are really seeing, I think, officers start to grow. We have seen a little movement from that. Over the weekend, Councilor Kim Roney, who had previously said that she was, you know, open to the bid and, you know, had some skepticism and some concerns, but was open to the proposal, has since shifted to just being outright against the bid. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that's due to public outrage about this growing. Then City Council will vote on the bid at its next two meetings, which will probably be May and June, because for the next few months they may only have one meeting. So at their next meetings, they have to vote on it two successive readings. So basically, you know, any action folks can do, we provide council members' direct phone numbers in there if people want to call them up and express their outrage. And, you know, the bid may seem inevitable right now, but it's supposedly inevitable last time, too, right up until the second it wasn't. And proposals in the last 2 years to basically ban mutual aid, ban giving, you know, food or cash to homeless folks that the city kind of assumed were inevitable also floundered when faced with a lot of public opposition. And frankly, you know, if council's not respecting you, obviously people should consider, you know, the how they do tactics and stuff, but, like, I would say, you know, folks, there's plenty of public comment stuff in council on other issues. Anything that can kind of be tied to the bid or an open public comment in other meetings, I think folks should feel absolutely free to keep hammering this, especially how untransparent it is, you know, especially how much of a, like, quasi-police state it's going to put into place. But, you know, it is, you know, folks basically should do whatever. Don't rely on one public hearing.
Right.
Like, you know, feel free to show up, speak, but, you know, any method they can use to bring pressure, I think, is absolutely justified at this point. As the bid passes, I think attention definitely should turn on the public side, whether it's through lawsuits or protests, or whatever other tactics people decide on, communities decide on, to basically make it very hard for it to operate in the ground.
Mm. Well, I appreciate you bringing this all to our attention, and we'll obviously follow the story and have you back to talk about where it's going.
Yes, look forward to it.
You can find the Blade's article, Stop the Bid, at AshevilleBlade.com.
Programming support is brought to you by The Organic Mechanic. Located at 568 Haywood Road in West Asheville, The Organic Mechanic specializes in all the services, repairs, and maintenance your vehicle needs. Reducing the impact on the environment is their top priority. More info is at organic-mechanic.com or 828-255-2628.
Returning to a city or starting a new life in Asheville can be very difficult for many, but it is especially hard if you're returning from prison. Operation Gateway is a nonprofit that is trying to help formerly incarcerated citizens with the transition. Earlier this week, I spoke with Amanda Layton, advocacy change agent with the organization, about their work. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So I've known Philip Cooper, or known of him for a while, and some other folks that are involved with Operation Gateway. But I'm wondering if you could just kind of tell some of our listeners what the organization's mission is and what how you actually achieve that.
So our mission is to decrease recidivism by addressing the social determinants of health of returning citizens, people that are returning from incarceration. And we try to address their social determinants of health. And there's five of those: economic stability. We try to find people jobs, second chance, fair employment with upward movement that has a living wage. Education, we offer access to quality education and training and certifications. Quality healthcare access, we try to make sure everyone gets on some sort of insurance because it's a holistic approach. You know, you have to treat the whole person. Neighborhood built environment, we try to address the housing issue, transportation issue, and try to get people going as soon as they get home from prison. So we do a 90-day reach-in, and we talk to people that are inside. We introduce ourselves to them via the Getting Out app, or we write them a letter, and we ask them if they would be interested in our services. And then once they respond to us, we develop a plan for them to come home. We get them on the first day that they're home, and we, you know, get started with everything. You know, there's a lot to do when you come home from prison, and it can be very overwhelming.
Yeah, why don't we talk a little bit about that? Because, you know, I've talked to folks who are returning from prison, and some the families are gone, right? Some are in cities that they came out of the prison from, and they're not even from the area, don't know anyone. Let alone being able to find a job. So can you talk about some of the obstacles and what those folks are facing when they come out?
Well, we try to, we perform the assessment, the needs assessment before they come home. And then part of the process is, you know, reconnections with family. A lot of people start out here, in transitional housing, and we help them navigate that before they come home. Reconnecting with family is like a big thing. And a lot of times people need a fresh start somewhere else. So they come here and we work on everything, you know, all the social determinants of health, you know, safe housing, recovery from addiction, meetings. We take people to NA meetings. We help people get their driver's license restored. We provide, you know, healthcare and transportation to appointments. Parole officers, things like that. But family is definitely part of it, and we like to try to reconnect people with their family as much as possible. And not only do we help the person coming home, but we also work with the family.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And let's talk about why. Some folks might not think that this is a worthy cause. Why should we help somebody who is a known criminal, et cetera, et cetera?
Right. On January 29th, 2024, Governor Cooper signed an executive order that calls for a unified approach to improving reentry services and rehabilitation. And, it's a matter of public safety. We need to do more rehabilitating inside the prison system. That's not happening. And people coming home were the grassroots effort to help them get their lives back in order. But it's a matter of public safety, because when someone goes to prison and they pay their debt to society, when that ends and they come home, they shouldn't leave prison and feel like they're still in prison. Like, people are going to prison, they're paying their debt. And when they come home, effective reentry services help people become a productive taxpaying member of society. I mean, if we continue to do what we have always done, we're going to get what we always got. And people are going to go back to what they know to survive. You know, people come home, they can't get food stamps. they can't get a place to live on their own without going to transitional housing because now they're marked a felon. And yes, they have created some of these things themselves, but they've gone on and paid their debt. So when they come home, they should have the chance, the second chance, to get their lives in order and become productive members of society. And when they can't get food or shelter, people go back to what they know, and that's crime. And I really feel like, you know, if we address the root cause of crime, we can address recidivism and people not ending up going to prison. A lot of the times the root causes of crime are, you know, family conditions, cultural, social, economic, poverty, and addiction. You know, addiction is an underlying cause that, you know, helps people commit crimes. And so I think if we could address those things, especially while they're in prison, and give them some sort of classes or education, when they come home, they're going to be ready to get their lives started. But when they come home and they don't have anyone to turn to and everything is coming against them and no one wants to hire them, it can be very disheartening and frustrating. So that's where we come in. You know, we make connections with employers in the community who will give people second chances. I personally came as a general manager from a second chance employment. I'm a person that's formerly incarcerated. I'm also a person in long-term recovery from addiction. And so I was intentful in hiring people straight from prison, and also people in recovery, because I feel like those people that need a second chance, they're my best employees. And so now I've gone on to work in the field, and the person that I actually hired straight from prison has now taken my place as the general manager of that restaurant, and she is the general manager. So I've always found that people that need that chance, when given the proper resources, will run with it, and they'll make your best employees.
Yeah, thanks for sharing your story. And that is also something unique, I think, to Operation Gateway, which is the certified community health workers. Do you want to talk about that program and how that works?
Right. So we are all certified community health workers, and everyone that works at Operation Gateway has been formerly incarcerated. They're actually, you know, they've been the closest to the problem, and now we're trying to be the closest to the solution. A community health worker is a frontline public health worker who's a trusted member of our community that we serve. And so we're resource navigators. If we don't have the resource and we can't provide it at Operation Gateway, we will find someone in the community that can provide the resource. And so community health workers bridge the gaps. And so most of us are peer support specialists because we are in recovery from addiction, but also we're community health workers because that resource navigation is, you know, the most important thing to bridge those gaps so people don't fall in them.
And having that unique experience of actually being formerly incarcerated, I'm sure opens up a whole window into the life that the person that you're trying to help. It gives you a perspective that nobody else can really understand. Can you give me an example of maybe, without using names, you know, just how that has played out in some of your line of work?
Well, because I have the lived experience, I think people can relate to me. You know, they're not just somebody that has a degree. I mean, I'm working on my degree right now, but, you know, they've actually been there. I've been in their shoes. They understand that I've been there. And I know how to walk through the process because I walked through it. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of reentry services when I walked through the process. So this is amazing. And it's very needed in our state, across the country. And so, like, it's amazing to see people come home. I mean, some people have been incarcerated for quite a bit of time. So, like, they come home and they don't even know how to work a smartphone. So these are things that we're working with people. We're teaching them, you know, society's changed. The world is different. And so we walk through that with people. I have somebody that's come here from a small town because they know there's no infrastructure in their town. And if they go back there, they're going to get what they always got because they don't have a lot of resources. So a lot of people come to Buncombe County because we are resource rich. And so that being said, they're coming from these counties that don't even have public transportation, not even Uber or Lyft. So I get on the bus with people and I navigate that with them so they're not scared of it. I'll ride the bus with someone from their transitional house to the bus station and then to their job and ride it back with them so that they can navigate those kind of things. These are things that people really have to navigate, you know, and just starting the process from the bottom, it's a lot to take in. It can be very overwhelming. So, you know, we start with vital records, you know, we get people their ID, their social security cards, and just walking through that process with them and having that lived experience, they feel supported and safe. And, you know, it's great to see the light come on, like, hey, all these resources are here. I don't have to live that old life that I lived. I can be a productive member of society. Look at these people that are doing it, you know, and they have careers. This has become a career to me. But not only that, advocacy is at the core of all that we do. And it's my favorite thing to do is to advocate for people at a state level, at a local level. And I just feel like this is more than a career to me. This is, I want to give back to the community that I took from, you know? And so I like to watch the light come on in people's eyes and see that they can do this, that it's possible. And when we support them, they can get through it and they can become productive members of society. And like I said, it's a matter of public safety. If we can't help people after they've paid their debt for the things that they've done, get back to a normal life, then we're going to have people continuing going back to prison, recidivizing, and continuing with a life of crime, because that's their only option, because they can't provide food for themselves. They can't provide a roof over them heads, over their heads, excuse me. So
yeah,
I really enjoy my work.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. How long has Operation Gateway been in operation?
So we have been in operation, oh Lord, you would ask me that. I believe we got our 501c back in 2021, and you know, everything's really come together in the past year. We went from having about 3 employees to actually employing about 9 people now. So things are coming along rather quickly, and you know, we're learning as we go.
Yeah.
And we're making a big difference, and I'm proud to be part of this organization.
Yeah.
And don't quote me on the timeline.
That's okay. I'm just trying to get a sense, because it seems like you guys are, you know, actively fundraising. You're a nonprofit, 501c3. Tell us about your, you have an event coming up, I think, that's about raising funds, right?
Yes. So April is Second Chance Month, and we are having our first inaugural Second Chance Gala. And so you can purchase tickets and donate at www.operationgateway.org/gala. And I just think it's going to be a great, amazing time. It's, you know, a time of appreciation and celebration for all the progress we have made in such a short period of time. And, you know, the community that we're building with, and, you know, we're collaborating with other organizations in town. And, you know, I think that our justice system should be based on the simple premise that once someone completes their sentence, they should have the chance to earn a living, build a life, and participate in our democracy as fellow citizens. So this is very important to us. We're going to have the debut of our short film, shout out to Counterflow for helping us produce that. We're going to have catering from a local nonprofit, Umoja Health Collective. So they're doing big things in the community as well. And we're going to have a silent auction to raise money. And, you know, if you feel inclined to donate, we would, to our cause, we would really appreciate it and be very, very grateful for it.
Well, it sounds amazing what you all have done so on such a short, you know, timeline. And I wish you all the best of luck in your inaugural gala. Anything else you want to add before we let you go, Amanda?
It's the inaugural gala, Wednesday, April 24th. It's 8 days away, and there are still time to get tickets and get involved.
Awesome. Well, thank you again. I appreciate your time so much.
Thank you for having me.
In order to effectively advocate local government to move toward racial justice, advocacy groups and the general public need timely information regarding local policy decisions. The Government Accountability Project Asheville, GAP-AVL, analyzes the most urgent matters, making their way through local politics, and distills what is most important to racial justice. Subscribe to GAP-AVL's regular newsletters at gapavl.org.
Drew Lischke is the co-chair for the North Carolina Justice for All Party, who is endorsing Dr. Cornel West for president of the United States in this year's election. The party is trying to get established here in the state to get West listed on the ballot. And they joined me earlier this week to talk about their efforts. Drew, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me, KP.
Yeah. So, your party just formed a few months ago?
Yeah, that's true. A couple months ago, a group of grassroots organizers kind of came together and decided that in North Carolina, we needed a legitimate alternative to this corporatist duopoly of the DNC and the GOP.
Right.
Yeah, so we created this party. It's called the Justice for All Party of North Carolina.
And are you guys associated with a national movement?
We are associated with a national movement, actually. So the party was formed initially at the behest of Dr. Cornel West. He is a left-wing academic who's running for president. And he's officially on the ballot in about 7 different states. He's achieved that through various means, including winning party primaries, third party primaries in other states, such as South Carolina. But in the majority of the states in the U.S., he is not yet on the ballot. He has no formal party structure to get on the ballot. So nationally, we've got about 43 brand new parties to kind of help him out with that. So the North Carolina Justice for All Party is part of this national movement where Justice for All parties are popping up everywhere, and with the intent of getting Dr. West on the ballot come November.
Right. And I'm sure many of our listeners are familiar with Cornel West, the first black person to receive a PhD from Princeton. Princeton University professor, as well as Harvard University. He's run for president before, but maybe you could tell us a little bit about his running mate, because he just announced that recently.
Yeah, so he just announced in some of those states, in order to start formally petitioning, you need to have both your presidential candidate and your vice presidential candidate. So they were stalled for a while in many states for this petitioning process. That was, yes, until last week when Dr. West announced that he would be running with Dr. Melina Abdullah. Dr. Melina Abdullah is a fellow leftist professor, and more notably, I'd say, she is one of the original founders of the Black Lives Matter movement. And I know that maybe there are some cynics out there who think that Black Lives Matter has been co-opted. Well, I'm happy to assure you that Dr. Melina Abdullah did not sell out, and in fact has a serious issue with the way that BLM, the national movement, was corporatized. And she refuses to let them have the name, and so she says that we are the true BLM grassroots movement. She's a really impressive woman, and... yeah, she and Dr. West are, I think, going to be a really great partnership when it comes to this campaign.
Yeah. Obviously, you mentioned the, you know, two-party duopoly. I like that reference. And I'm curious, you know, the third party runs. We also have RFK running, Robert Kennedy Jr. running. You know, what's the goal, really, for your organization? You know, winning maybe, but really that would be a very difficult challenge to achieve. But more importantly, what are you trying to get across to voters?
Absolutely. KP, so I'll say this. I think that's a terrific question. And that's something that we've discussed at length as party leadership. We've decided that after this federal election push, we're going to shift our focus to more local and state politics, doing real left-wing wealth redistribution on a local level. And through creative policies that actually help people in the immediacy. So as far as it comes to, you know, our hopes of winning, yeah, of course, it would be great to win. I think Dr. West would be a fantastic president. And I think he is a voice of reason and an independent voice of reason and love and morality that is so needed on the national stage right now. And I think that's great. However, I want North Carolinians to look beyond this election. I want to look at, part of our policy platform is we're going to run somebody for state commissioner of labor and get a little nasty in the courts about North Carolina's right to work laws. These are like the creative solutions that the DNC is not willing to provide because, in fact, they don't care. And they'll hold these solutions above our heads like carrots. And, you know, it's actually time to get something really done. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to achieve that in local levels. Right now, Dr. West is our ticket to gaining access to the ballot. Once we gain access to the ballot as a party, through Dr. West's campaign and candidacy, we'll maintain access to the ballot, and you'll be able to see North Carolina Justice for All party members running for a whole plethora of positions in the next coming years.
Gotcha.
And all I'll say is that right now, I know this election is really contentious, mm-hmm. and nobody's happy with either candidates from the DNC or the GOP. And if you think it's bad now, I'll say give you two more election cycles. See who our options are then. Right now, we're playing the long game. If we don't have this infrastructural, this party in place, this institution kind of formalized and legitimated and popularized through North Carolina and the nation, I guarantee you in two more election cycles, the duopoly will be even worse.
Yeah.
That's what we're looking for.
I have to ask the question that it's probably on many people's minds. We know there's a lot at stake at this next election, and certainly the Democrats have been pushing the belief that it's about our democracy and whether or not mm-hmm. it exists or remains intact if mm-hmm. Trump is elected. And so, what do you tell voters who are in that mindset?
Yeah, I always, and this is what I've come across while petitioning in public, is a lot of people are really scared about votes being taken away from Biden. And what I'd say to that is that, first of all, having more candidates on a ballot is inherently pro-democratic. If you have more voices for people to choose from, that is democracy. So if Democrats think that we're saving the republic by ensuring that there are no other voices to be heard on the ballot, that's inherently anti-democratic in itself. And this is the state DNC, the Democratic Convention of North Carolina, right? The group that runs and oversees North Carolinian politics. They have made it very clear that their goal is to be as obstructionist as possible when it comes to third parties mm. on the ballot. We saw it with the Matt Ho campaign for governor. The DNC Board of Election threw out 14,000 legitimate signatures through the courts and said, you know what, actually those signatures don't count toward legitimate petitions, and effectively barred Matt Ho from running. Matt Ho, if y'all would remember, he was the candidate who really gained notoriety in North Carolina due to leaning into a pro-legalization of marijuana agenda. Mm. And he was essentially barred from running. So I would say that the state of democracy in America is already at a really dire point. And it's not Trump. Trump's not the biggest threat, I think. I mean, he might be the most obvious and obnoxiously loud threat, but it's these more maniacal things that go unnoticed that I think are truly dangerous for democracy. And so that's what I generally say. If we're going to protect democracy by sinking the ship, that's not something I want to be involved in. Beyond that, I think the futility of actually trying to win North Carolina with Joe Biden at his lowest popularity ratings with 2016 and 2020, regardless of the Electoral College's vote, North Carolina going red for Trump, with Trump being a martyr for the cause by being pulled into all these courts, I think it's quite silly that anyone thinks that Joe Biden can win North Carolina this election cycle anyway. Mm. All due respect to those who hold that view, but I do think it's a little silly. Okay. So that's what I'd say to counter that.
Yeah, thank you for that. And you mentioned signatures, so I'm assuming you're on a campaign for signatures as well.
Yes, that is correct. So in order to gain access to the ballot and thus officially nominate Dr. Cornel West, the North Carolina Board of Elections requires that we as a new party collect nearly 14,000 signatures from registered voters in North Carolina. Our petitioning effort is well underway at this point, and we need as much help as possible to get the job done before our filing deadline on May 17th. So that's kind of my plea to listeners. If you're interested in the work we're doing, in the potential that North Carolina Justice for All Party has for the state of North Carolina in this election and elections coming up, you can sign the petition, volunteer to help gather petitions, anything like that. If any of that interests you, please shoot us a message on Instagram. The Instagram handle is @justiceforall_NC.
Melody and Mayhem with host Dog Eye is every Friday from 11 p.m. to 2 a.m. on Asheville FM. Experimental, genre-defying music for all ages and from all ages. Pretty much anything is fair game here, but there is an emphasis on minimal electronics of the non-dance persuasion, as well as post-classical, between-the-cracks rock, and some good-time music concrete when it can be found. The show will also give emphasis to new releases when they come in. It's non-serious music for the academic listener. That's Melody and Mayhem every Friday at 11 p.m. right here on Asheville FM.
Hi, I'm Dr. Dick Needleman, health reporter for 103.3 Asheville FM, with this week's Healthy Asheville Health Report. In local news, respiratory infections like COVID-19, influenza, and RSD are characterized by being more prevalent during the winter months. With the recent onset of spring, the winter surge of respiratory infections has passed. However, over the past 3 years, COVID-19 infections have also surged in August. Therefore, the weekly update will continue to report on COVID-19 and restart influenza and RSV updates in the fall. The CDC's COVID dashboard for the week ending on April 6th shows hospital admission levels are low in every county in North Carolina, including Buncombe County. They are low in more than 99% of the counties in the U.S. and less than 1% at medium and high levels. Admissions have decreased in the U.S. and North Carolina from the previous week. Between 1 to 9 deaths in North Carolina were due to COVID, the lowest level of 5 groups. Emergency room visits for COVID-19 are minimal in North Carolina. This is about 1% of all ER visits, the lowest level of 5 groups. Wastewater monitoring can be used to provide early warning for COVID outbreaks. The Buncombe and Henderson County's wastewater data on the North Carolina COVID dashboard for the week ending on April 3rd shows the number of viral gene copies in each water sample is at an orange level, representing the second highest of 5 groups, currently between the 60th and 80th percentile relative to the past level measured at the same site. The 15-day rate of change of the number of viral gene copies in each water sample has increased from the previous week, between 10 to 99%, the middle level of 3 groups for a positive rate of change. Have you had a reason to grieve lately? Grief can affect your mental and physical health, particularly after the loss of a member of the family. We can develop such a close relationship to a pet, like a dog or a cat, that we consider our pet to be a member of our family. A feeling of grief in response to the loss of a pet may be similar to the loss of a person. However, the grieving process is different for everyone. According to the American Psychological Association, quote, grief is the anguish experienced after significant loss, unquote. I definitely think that this applies to the loss of a pet. Jennifer Breslau, a psychotherapist who specializes in pet loss counseling, said, quote, "The death of a pet is a devastating loss, and people often feel overwhelmed by the emptiness and void they feel when their pet is gone," unquote. She added, quote, "Grieving is a process that takes time and is filled with a mess of uncomfortable feelings, but it is temporary and a normal human response to a significant loss," unquote. "I lost my beloved companion Brady on April 1st at the age of 13. He was a majestic-looking golden retriever who was always happy to see me with his tail wagging, infectious smile, and frequent licking. We had many great times together, and Brady did some crazy things. After he passed, I read that there is a 61% risk that this popular breed will develop cancer. In 2010, I lost my first golden retriever, Rocky, to cancer at the age of 11. His passing brought me many days of grief. When I finally got over it, we brought home Brady 1 year later. After age 11, Brady developed 4 different cancers at 4 different times. 3 of his cancers got better with surgery. However, the 4th cancer had the worst prognosis because it was destined to spread. Amputation and chemotherapy prolonged his life for 8 months. After 1 month recovering, he had 6 good months of being a happy dog. He was running with 3 legs and still had a great life. A second round of chemotherapy was begun after the cancer spread to his lungs 1 month ago. However, he had severe complications and was unable to walk much. There was a brief improvement, followed by a regression over the final 2 weeks. It isn't a good sign when your dog barks to be helped up, to go to the bathroom, or wants a new location in the yard or the house. When Brady refused to eat his meals, including his favorite treats, we knew that the quality of life has been severely compromised. When a close relative passes, people pass through 5 stages of grief, as described by the psychiatrist Elizabeth Kubler-Ross in 1969. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. A 6th stage of grief, finding meaning, was described by David Kessler, a grief expert and Kubler-Ross colleague, in 2016. I suspected that these stages are similar after the loss of your pet. According to Wallace Seif, the founder of the Association for Pet Loss Bereavement, APLB, there are 5 stages of pet grief. 1, shock, disbelief, and denial. 2, anger, distancing, and alienation. 3, guilt. 4, depression. And 5, resolution. I feel much better after having the opportunity to prepare and report this story to you during my grieving process. The ability to communicate with others is a great medicine. If you find yourself like me, feeling down from the loss of a pet, I suggest talking to others and staying active. I will celebrate all the good times that I had with Brady. Boy, was I fortunate to have had such a great companion. Colleen Rowland, a pet loss specialist at the APLB, said that having a pet is, quote, "one of the best gifts that life can offer, an unconditional love with an animal companion," unquote. This has been Dr. Dick Needleman with the Healthy Asheville Health Report. Let's keep Asheville healthy. For questions, feedback, comments, and more, please email me at healthyasheville@ashevillefm.org. Today's health report is posted on our website at www.ashevillefm.org.
Coming up next, No Borders, a new show right here on Asheville FM and in the app and online at ashevillefm.org. And now it's time for the Tailgate Market Report from the Appalachian Sustainable Agriculture Project. Asparagus has arrived at farmers markets for spring. Asparagus packs a lot of nutrition, including vitamin A, potassium, iron, calcium, and antioxidants. This culinary staple can be cooked in many ways, including a delicious pasta primavera. Did you know that primavera means spring in Italian? What better way to kick off the season than a classic, flavorful dish that encapsulates spring? Look for asparagus at McConnell Farms at North Asheville Tailgate Market and Root Bottom Farm at West Asheville Tailgate Market. To begin, you'll need to boil a large pot of salted water over medium heat. While the water is coming to a boil, start slicing up snow peas and asparagus stems into 1/4-inch thick pieces. Leave asparagus tips whole. Once sliced, melt 1 tablespoon of butter into a large skillet over medium-high heat. Add your snap peas and asparagus. If you want more flavor, add any spring alliums such as sliced scallions, garlic, spring onions, chives, shallots, or leeks into the mix. Cook vegetables 3 to 4 minutes or until all the vegetables are slightly tender. Season with salt and pepper and set aside. Add pasta to the boiling water and cook until al dente, 1 to 3 minutes for fresh pasta, more for dried pasta. Drain the pasta and transfer it into the vegetables. On low heat, add 2/3 of a cup of grated Parmigiano Reggiano, 1/2 cup of creme fraiche, and 3 tablespoons of finely chopped herbs, such as dill, parsley, and fennel, with the pasta and vegetables. Once all ingredients are thoroughly mixed, serve and enjoy. You can find all your vegetables and herbs from Flying Cloud Farm at North Asheville Tailgate Market, Small Holding Farm at Weaverville, and Wicked Fresh Gardens at Asheville City Market. Want to add more protein? You can add chicken, shrimp, or even mushrooms such as portobello, chanterelle, morels, porcini, and black trumpets. Look for chicken from Wild East Farm at River Arts District Farmers Market or Dillingham Family Farm at Weaverville Tailgate Market. Mushrooms can be found from Black Trumpet Farm at River Arts District and North Asheville Markets, Forest Pharmacy at Asheville City Market, and Ivy Creek Family Farm at North Asheville and Weaverville Markets. Farmers Markets now also have greens, broccoli, beets, sweet potatoes, radishes, cabbages, and more. Markets are stocked with a variety of rice, pasta, pastries, drinks, and prepared foods. You can find more details about farms and markets throughout the region, including spring hours, in ASAP's online local food guide at appalachiangrown.org. And this has been your weekly Tailgate Market Report from the Appalachian Sustainable Agriculture Project and your community radio station, 103.3 Asheville FM.
Well, that about does it for the Asheville FM News Hour. I'm News Team Correspondent KP Whaley, and I'd like to give special thanks to Patrick Battle, Walker Spruill, Dick Needleman, and Cannon Wiest for their contributions to the News Hour. Tune in every Wednesday at 11 a.m. and stay tuned next for No Borders here on Asheville FM. Thanks for tuning in.
My name is Bootsy, baby, and you're listening to Asheville FM, WSFM, LP 103.3. Asheville, Bobble. Yeah.
Reimagine Asheville invites you to think about ways Asheville could be different. What if you offered long-term housing instead of running an Airbnb? Reimagine Asheville.
Why not?